You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
More children than ever have been diagnosed with chronic illnesses such as autism, asthma, and cancer. Philip and Alice Shebikoff contend that industrial chemicals and toxins in the environment can trigger these and other diseases. Their latest book, Poison Prophets, The Toxic Assault on Our Children, documents their research, findings, and recommendations. It's published by Random House. I'm pleased that it brings Philip Shebikoff and Alice Shebikoff to the show today. Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
The subtitle of your book is The Toxic Assault on Our Children. Assault is a pretty accusative word. Are you saying corporate America is criminally responsible for damaging our children's health?
We have cast our book as a crime story with the children as victims and their families as victims, with those who put these toxins in the environment as perpetrators, with government agencies who fail to carry out the laws or to produce new laws to protect them as co-conspirators. Oh, when we say criminal crime, we're using that as a metaphor. We don't mean it is actually a crime punishable under our current system of criminal justice, although in some cases it may be. But the parallels to a crime struck us as we gathered this material, and we've called it such.
And you're dealing specifically with children. Aren't we all subject to environmental toxins?
Yes, indeed we are. We focused on children for two reasons. First, we thought people care the most. They may ignore problems for themselves, but they care the most about their kids. And then secondly, children are physiologically more vulnerable. Their systems have not yet developed the kind of defenses that an adult's body has. And kids, like their kidneys, for example, retain mercury at about twice the level of an adult. We used to think the placenta would filter out chemicals and other toxins for a baby in the womb, and now we find that's not the case. And so kids are physically more vulnerable from the day they are conceived, and in some cases, we think, even before they are even conceived.
Isn't one of the problems that when some children are claimed to have been affected, there are other children in the same environment, sometimes in the same family, who've gone through the same things, who haven't been affected?
Yes. There are a lot of factors involved, Leonard, in childhood diseases caused by toxins in the environment. Genetics is certainly a major factor. Some children are more genetically susceptible to others. They may be exposed to the same chemical or the same heavy metal or the same nuclear waste and not get sick, and somebody in the same family might get sick from the same exposure. Something we heard again and again as we interviewed scientists and physicians for this book was that genetics loads the gun, but the environment pulls the trigger.
So you can be genetically predisposed, but then you need something to trigger the condition.
Yes, and the reason that we believe that our book is not a cry of woe, but instead a note of optimism, is now we know what lies behind the enormous statistics of increased childhood illnesses. Now we know, so now we can address the problem and do something to eliminate it.
Well, you say now we know, but isn't this still something that is subject to great debate? There was a recent court case that came to the conclusion that the MMR vaccine had nothing to do with the autism epidemic. We have letters to the newspapers every day from physicians saying that they feel great sympathy to the parents of autistic children, but they think that talking about mercury and vaccines and the like has caused more trouble and done more damage. In fact, we even have an actress, I think, who's gotten involved in all of this.
Yep. That is the case, but it is the connection between vaccines with mercury and autism is not 100% clear, but I would bet my bottom dollar that in years to come, a connection will be found. But the connection between mercury and autism, let's say mercury from coal-powered plants or mercury from any item that contains it, which in fact a lot of, I think we just found out that half of all items, all industrial items made with industrial chemicals have mercury in them. So mercury is around in a lot more than just vaccines. And another item that can cause kids to exhibit autism is our pesticides.
Leonard, on the mercury issue, we interviewed the former head of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, Dr. Ken Olden. And what he said to us is that people have said that thimerosal, the mercury in vaccines, now banned, causes autism. And he said, well, whether I believe that or not, I do know that mercury is a poison. And why would you want to put a poison in the bodies of little children?
A recent study at the University of California, Davis, found that since 1990, there's been a 7- to 8-fold increase in autism in California. The researchers also believe this increase is likely due to environmental factors. How do we prove this sort of thing? Scientists on the other side say that the key factor in autism is genetics, and that the statistical rise in autism cases is due to increased reporting and an expansion of the definition of autism?
Well, yes, they do say that, and it's hard to prove any of these things. It's almost impossible to prove that a specific chemical cause a specific disease in a specific child in a specific place. But what we have done in our book is present a weight of evidence from epidemiological studies, from tests on laboratory animals, from new emerging toxicology technologies such as toxicogenomics, which can find the fingerprints of individual chemicals on individual genes in sick children. And when you look at that weight evidence, you find that there is an association, not proof, because you can't prove it, but an association of these substances with diseases such as autism and cancer and asthma and birth defects and other neurological illnesses.
My guests are Philip Shabakov and Alice Shabakov, both journalists. He was the chief environmental correspondent for the New York Times for 14 of the 32 years that he worked there as a reporter. And she was executive director of the National Consumers League, which is the country's oldest consumer organization, and executive director of the National Nonprofit Community Information Exchange. Their book, Poison Profits, The Toxic Assault on Our Children, is published by Random House. There is less disagreement over the environmental impact on some things, like cleft palates and lips. Is that because those are things that are more easily treated, or because there's less money involved?
In fact, there's debate about the cause of birth defects like cleft palates in some cases. Our book opens with the story of a community in outside of Nashville where 19 kids were born with cleft palates in a 2-year period, and it was traced back, the parents traced it back to well water that was serving their houses that had the same ingredient in it, a long ingredient called trichloroethylene, same ingredient that, do you remember the civil action movie and book, same ingredients, still in American water supplies. And when the parents sued the company that had put this chemical in the, dumped it into the water, they are right now in the middle of that lawsuit, but probably they're going to lose it. Nobody has regulated that trichloroethylene for all these decades.
Yeah. The Academy Award-winning short this year was called Pinky, and it was about cleft palates in India. And the film makes a direct link between poverty and cleft palates because of the conditions that poor people live in.
That's a good point, Leonard. Poor people, minorities, recent immigrants, and others who lack the political power to force cleanup of their neighborhood, who are forced to live in marginal areas near industrial sites or toxic waste dumps, have children who are mostly exposed, more exposed to these than other children. And they do have higher rates of these diseases. But the point we like to emphasize is that no child in America, or anywhere in the world for that matter, is safe in these things, no matter how clean and rich their community, how well-ordered their schools, how careful their parents. This stuff is everywhere. Some of the highest toxic loadings in the world are found in the bodies of Inuits up above the Arctic Circle. There isn't a place on Earth that doesn't have toxic molecules in it.
But do we have more? You say the United States makes or imports 42 billion pounds of chemicals per day.
Yes.
Now, not all of them are toxic,
no,
I assume.
No, not all of them are toxic. We have 80,000 chemicals in use, but part of the problem is that these chemicals are not required to be tested. The testing falls into the purview of the manufacturer. He has no obligation to test for safety to humans or the environment. He reports to EPA only the chemical structure and how many pounds he proposes to produce in a year, and a figure that he can change at will without telling EPA.
So they don't have to go through the same kind of testing a drug has to undergo.
And that's the problem.
Same chemical.
We just don't know how many of these chemicals are toxic and represent a threat to human health. Many of them presumably are not, are perfectly safe. But because of the lack of testing for health, and only a fraction of them have been tested for health, we simply don't know. We only see the effect.
You go one step further. You say companies can withhold information from the public record by saying it's a trade secret. It's a trade secret if something that they are putting into the environment is causing people to have cancer?
Indeed. That is exactly the case.
They don't even have to tell the government where their facilities are located. They can say it's a matter of security to keep the whereabouts of their facilities secret. And, of course, they say that the ingredients are a matter of proprietary ownership, so they don't have to disclose that either.
So what leads to something like DDT being banned?
Independent researchers.
And Rachel Carson, the Silent Spring. I mean, it became a cause célèbre after Silent Spring was published.
There's also the possibility that a chemical can be perfectly benign, but then cause trouble when it's in combination with other chemicals?
Well, that's true. There is a growing body of research that exposure to multiple sources of chemicals can cause harm that individually those chemicals will not harm. Alice, can you think of a particular case at the moment?
Yes. One of them was atrazine. And there's a very famous scientist out in Berkeley who has been testing that. Atrazine is an herbicide used very widely in American corn crops. And he's been testing it in combinations and finds that sometimes if atrazine is not harmful, let's say, to a frog, but you put it in combinations with other chemicals, it will kill the frog. And another really interesting fact we came across is that just lifestyle problems can increase the susceptibility, like stress. If a tadpole is under stress and he's exposed to atrazine, he may die. And if it's not under stress, he might live. And a lot of us are under stress, and especially, as you mentioned before, Leonard, poor people.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back with more from Philip Shabakov and Alice Shabakov. Their book, Poison Prophets, The Toxic Assault on Our Children, is published by Random House. Stay with us. And we're back with Philip Shabakov, who was chief environmental correspondent for the New York Times for 14 of the 32 years he worked there. After leaving the Times, he founded and published Greenwire, an online daily digest of environmental news. Alice Shabakov is a journalist who focuses on family and consumer topics and has written for most of the major publications, was executive director of the National Consumers League, and also executive director of the National Nonprofit Community Information Exchange. They have collaborated on a book called Poison Profits, The Toxic Assault on Our Children. It is published by Random House. And I'm informed that the current Huffington Post today has reported that the government has conceded that there may be a link between vaccines and autism. So this fight continues.
Yes. Oh, may I just divert, Leonard, to say that?
Go wherever you want to go. I'll follow you.
I heard you say that previous authors have responded to comments on your website, and I promise to do the same. Anybody who writes to us with a question or a comment, we will respond to personally.
Because there is a lot of confusion about this. For example, those areas that have been called hotspots, I've seen that is also something that is rather controversial. Some people claim that there are these hotspots, like the one at Toms River, where 122 children came down with cancer, much higher than the national average. Others have said this is just a coincidence, or there are some other factors that may apply.
Yes, well, we did visit Toms River and talk to parents there and to government officials in the state of New Jersey, and one of the directors of the public health department of New Jersey said, well, we cannot prove that there is an association between the chemicals in the drinking water in Toms River and the more than 122 cases of childhood cancer that have been diagnosed there. But, he said, there is an association, and that association led them to take regulatory action to make the chemical companies involved there clean up their act and stop pouring it into the river and into the ground there.
So are we seeing less cancer in Toms River now?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
Since that happened there, I don't know what the rates are, but in Woburn, after they turned off the wells that were giving kids their birth defects and cancer, same kinds of chemicals, by the way, as in Toms River, and in the place that we talked about in Tennessee, the cancer rate went down to zero after they shut off those wells.
And it was sharply down in Toms River as well.
Well, are the people who live in these towns given any kind of compensation of the sort that we saw with the Love Canal, where people were relocated and reimbursed to some degree?
It's very rare. Sometimes families get compensation from the polluting companies by lawsuits, but it's usually the case when they do win a lawsuit, the details are kept secret, including and the company, as a condition of paying compensation to these families, insists that no bit of blame be kept be placed on their products. So it makes it very difficult for other families in the same situation to get compensation. I should say at this point, Leonard, that what we found is a whole industry that has built up around defending these toxic products. It's an industry that was based on the same strategies that was used by the tobacco industry to ward off government action for many years. And they use a whole range of chemical companies, other producers of toxic substances, use a whole range of techniques. They use advertising. They use public relations. They use intimidation of people who criticize the products. And mostly they use scientists. They hire scientists to produce the kind of results that they want that will keep their products in commerce. So families who try to get justice from the chemical companies when their children grow sick are in a vastly unequal contest.
I want to ask you about the Marisol, because it's been pointed out that it was taken out of children's vaccines. Interestingly, after it was taken out of the fluid that is used to clean contact lenses, But I recently was offered a flu shot, and I was looking at what that involved, and there was that name, Thimerosal. Why not take it out of everything?
Because it's our understanding that vaccines that are packaged so that in larger tubes so they can be used for multiple people reward the manufacturer with a slightly higher profit. But I think you can demand a flu shot without a preservative, and it would be a one-person flu shot, and that's what we would recommend for kids especially.
In the chapter Scene of the Crime, you take readers through the house room by room. In the nursery, which you say is probably the most toxic room in the house, there might be furniture built with formaldehyde, mattresses and clothing made with flame retardants, plastic, phthalate-containing toys. It's a bit overwhelming. How can people protect themselves without living in a bubble?
Well, first of all, we were very careful in fact, we gave brand names of products that had these toxins in them and then brand names of products that don't. So you can look through our appendix. We have a short but to-the-point appendix for parents on how to minimize their kids' risks, and in it you'll find all the sites that you need to go to find out whether your cosmetics have bad ingredients in it, whether the fish has high level of mercury, what kind of crib has formaldehyde and what kind doesn't. It's a little bit of work. It puts the emphasis on the parent as the safeguard, and we're hoping that with our book we could stimulate some interest in making a more widespread change that would involve civil action on the part of parents and regulation on the part of government.
That's right. Leonard, we do make the point that there are a lot of things parents can do to safeguard their children, but there is no way that we can consume our way out of this problem. There have to be firewalls to prevent to deal with the excesses and misdeeds of manufacturers. Now, we say that the people who do this are not bad people. They don't set out to harm anybody, much less children. But the imperatives of our market system causes them to seek the highest possible profit.
But also, aren't the things that you're recommending costlier than what is being done right now?
Well, it depends on how you look at cost. Yes, individual products might cost more money. But when you look at the statistics of how much these childhood illnesses are costing Americans, the families, and the nation as a whole, I think the figure we have is, Alice, you...
Yeah, just four of these chronic illnesses of kids cost the nation $54.9 billion a year, plus then you add to that $77.7 billion a year for special ed, and about half of the chemicals in use today are known to affect the brain and the nervous system. So what we have said is that the costs, we are socializing the costs and privatizing the gain. And to us it seems very reminiscent of what's happening in the financial markets, where deregulation and nonchalant ignoring of the problem has brought about the calamity that we're facing financially. We say that we're facing a similar calamity when it comes to our kids' health.
Well, how can people avoid eating pesticides, for example? Would it help if we only bought foods and products labeled organic?
Yes, that would. But sometimes parents worry that if you buy only organic food, that will be very expensive. There are books that will tell you how to eat well without buying only organic, and our advice is, feed your kids organic foods full of foods that they eat the most, and most particularly, I would say, fruits, vegetables, milk, eggs, and chicken.
There was legislation passed in the 1990s that requires manufacturers who use pesticides on foods to provide a tenfold margin of safety for children. That is to say, the standards used for adults would have to be changed to make it them 10 times more stringent for children. The problem is only a handful of pesticides have been so regulated. The rule has been breached almost repeatedly. We can hope now that a new administration will pay more attention to these issues. But even
with words like organic or environmentally safe and the like, I understand. I'm not talking about food necessarily, but there are a lot of other products out there, cleaning products and the like, that are. It's hard to tell really whether they're safe or not, even though they have those words on the label.
You're absolutely right, but organic does have to meet a national standard, and so I trust it. As for cleaning products, if it says natural, if any food or cleaning product says natural, that has absolutely no value. That's just an advertising term. Leonard, I thought that if you compare the cost to a manufacturer of producing a product that is poisonous, at least to some kids, with the cost that a parent or a family or a nation spends on trying to educate and heal our children, that the trade-off is not really great. In fact, I think the trade-off comes off in favor of protect rather than harm.
But we need a broader approach to this. And in fact, the European Union is in the process of implementing a broader approach to the problem of chemical contamination of the environment and its effect on public health.
Well, you talk about the precautionary principle. Is that what they're applying in the EU?
That is exactly right, Lynn.
How would that work?
Okay. When there is weight of evidence that shows that a particular chemical or metal or nuclear material is causing harm to human health, then you apply the precautionary principle. You remove that product from commerce. Now, of course, we cannot do without chemicals. You know, they are the basic building blocks of our modern industrial society. So what do we do? Well, the answer is we replace them with products that do not cause harm, with non-toxic products. And in fact, Leonard, there is a whole new field of science called green chemistry, which is learning to take the toxic molecules out of useful substances and replace them with non-toxic molecules. And that is what is starting to happen in Europe. And I don't see any reason, we don't see any reason that cannot happen here.
Well, I just spent the weekend with a lot of chefs, and they all seem to have certain things in common. They all are opposed to animals that have been treated with hormones and antibiotics,
yes.
And pretty much to a person, they are opposed to genetically modified foods. Now, is this simply because they're chefs and they're a bit snobbish about the sort of thing that they're serving?
Not at all. In fact, one of our big surprises was to find out that a lot of our cattle, not only does the cattle graze, hasn't been out in a pasture for all of their lives, and they're shut up very close to each other and fed corn, but they're also, they get little devices attached to their ears which feed them steroids minute after minute. And so the chefs seem to know that, and they're beginning to move away from that kind of cooking. And so is everybody who wants to protect their kids.
Now, we should get down to the nitty-gritty. We have a listener, Jennifer, in New York City, who left a comment on our show page, and she asks, are we safe vaccinating our children or not? I have a 16-month-old. I've been vaccinating him. The pediatrician says you should do that. And now she says she's a bit nervous about it. She keeps on hearing so much conflicting information.
Yes. Well,
how should she proceed? There are a lot of people who are saying we're going to have a measles epidemic if we stop using the MMR vaccine.
Well, we can only give you our opinion of that. We're not physicians, but yeah, we think that vaccinating children is important and should be done, but it should be done a better way. First of all, there's no reason to shove all these chemicals, all these vaccines into tiny little kids at the same time. They could be spaced out better.
But that would mean more money, wouldn't it?
well, do you care more about children or do you care about money? You know, it costs a lot of money to treat an autistic child. One family we interviewed in Cambridge up here that has an autistic child spends $100,000 a year dealing with the kid's illness. So that's a relative term. And also not just spacing them out, but using using no preservative if possible, or using a non-toxic, non-mercury preservative, and then in small amounts.
The father of an autistic son told me that one of the things he objects to in the MMR vaccine is the rubella part, rubella which has been linked to autism, because the reason it's being given is to prevent women from becoming pregnant when they have German measles. There's no German measles are not the most dangerous of all illnesses, and that's the girls. Why are they giving it to boys if it's not a danger to boys but may very well be linked to autism?
Yeah, I think that you could chalk that. We don't have a scientific answer for that, but it seems to us, based on the research we did for the book, that there are a lot of things that are taking place that are taught in medical school, and part of the education that goes on in medical school is dominated by manufacturers. We all know that from the book you talked about earlier today, the Big Pharma book. And it may be less expensive for a manufacturer to package three drugs together, but if the fact is right that rubella is needed only for a woman going to become pregnant, then I would ask, why couldn't we do exactly what you said and hold it away from small kids until a woman reaches childbearing decision?
Even if every chemical produced from now on was produced with green chemistry, we still have so much toxic waste around, and we have plastics all over the place, and you say many of the plastics are quite dangerous.
Yeah, the plastics are very, they're loaded with bisphenol A, which has been in the news very recently, and phthalates, which is, both of these are used to make the plastic more flexible.
But not all are. How do we even know whether something is made with phthalates or BPA?
Again, look in our book, in the appendix, for one of the organizations. There are a number of amazingly smart nonprofit environmental groups that have scientists on board or spend their own money to ship chemicals out to scientific labs, and they track the responses, the answers, in databases that you can find in our book.
We have two appendices. One of them gives specific advice on specific products to avoid or to use, and the second gives a lot of sources, websites and mailing addresses, of telephone numbers of sources of information parents can turn to. And but we also say that you know, do what you can, but you won't be able to do it all yourself. You need help from government.
Now, when you were at the New York Times, could you have written this sort of thing?
No. I certainly could not. This is, as we have been accused pejoratively of being a polemic, well, yes, we consciously set out to write a polemic because we wanted to stir people to action. We wanted to do something about this. We have been accused of being alarmists, but we need to be alarmed. This is alarming. We want to end disbelief and inertia on this issue. The Times, you know, would never have allowed me as a reporter to prescribe action, only to propose just the facts, ma'am.
What about your experience, Philip, with global warming?
Yeah, when I started writing about global warming in the 1970s, and just writing stories about with the scientific evidence, and I was accused of being alarmist. Well, it took 30 years for the public to become fully conscious of the seriousness of the threat of global warming. We can't wait 30 years to become convinced of the seriousness of the threat of the toxification of the environment. It is at least as big a threat to the viability of life on Earth as global warming has finally come to be recognized.
Thank you both so much for being with us. Philip Shabakov, Alice Shabakov, S-H-A-B-E-C-O-F-F. Their book, Poison Prophets, The Toxic Assault on Our Children, is published by Random House.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you, Leonard. It was wonderful.